that part of the promised land, at least. Okay, so any burning questions that we want to answer for the last true free play question and answer time? Everything you've been saving up for the entire year, now's the time to go.
Well, I don't know what you guys talked about last time. I wasn't here last week. But
this is a danger. You guys are letting Peter talk first. Remember what happened last time.
But I have kind of a question on, I don't know if you've been reading some of the emails lately, but just so I can have some clarification on some of that. As far as something following the scientific method, if something follows the scientific method, does that mean that thing is science? And does the thing have to be, like the process that someone is talking about, have to be itself observable? Or can someone say this is observable even though no one has ever seen it or can ever see it, but I see some results of it? And is that begging the question, or is that science?
Right. I'll give you I used to say 1 minute answer, I'll be honest in this case. I'll give you a 10 minute answer on this one, because it's a very, very, very important question. But it's actually something I'll defer most of that answer to the next couple months, because it's something that we'll have to talk about in those couple months. His question, let me restate it a couple ways, and I'll tell you why it's important. It's important because what you believe about physics today is part of that question. The theory of relativity itself, which is our best theory today, according to everybody who works in physics, of the large-scale structure of the universe, things like planets and the sun and galaxies and the universe itself and all the stuff that you see, Big Bang theory, galaxy formation theory, all the stuff when people are telling you this is how it happened 13.x billion years ago, it all comes from a principle of relativity, and the principle of relativity started with a philosophical assumption. And most people don't know, but Albert Einstein was influenced by Ernst Mach, who was a positivist in some ways, in many ways. And a positivist basically says this: if you can't, well, they say many things, but one of their conclusions is something like this: if you can't observe it, there's no way to know it's true. You go a step further and say, if it's not observed, it is therefore not true. So it's a strange way of looking at the world. Positivism has died philosophically since then, because a lot of philosophers came up and said, in a nice way, this is the dumbest thing we've ever heard. And Einstein started out basically as on a positivist mindset. Now, since when he did his special theory of relativity, you'll see that it basically is based in positivism. What it says is, everybody's seen the famous train, the kind of train example. So here's a train moving in this direction, and there's a fellow standing in it, and there's another fellow, here it is on the tracks, and there's another fellow on the rail platform, and this guy, a pair of lightning bolts hits the train on either end of it. This guy sees them happen at the same time. This guy sees this one happen first, and then this one happen because as he's moving in this direction, the light waves kind of get compacted, and he's moving. These are trying to catch up to him. So basically, without going through the physics of it, they disagree on whether this is simultaneous. And the question that they were trying to answer was, or one of the things they were addressing was, Newton said there's absolute space and absolute time. Einstein came through and said that's not the case. They are completely relative. And because this guy and this guy can't agree, there is no absolute. Now, as it turns out, there is an absolute. There's a couple ways to get an absolute. We won't go into it now. But this is special theory of relativity. Went to the general theory of relativity, where you start putting gravity into this kind of stuff. You realize that this doesn't work. So even though we think of special relativity and general relativity as these are both Einstein's thing, and it's one continuous thought, completely different philosophical bases, although general relativity kept some of this positivist approach. But they believed in something called an operational definition. If you can't make an operational definition of what's going on, that's the only, or rather, when you make an operational definition of what's going on, your observation, that's the only real truth. Anything else out there is, in your mind, it's illusory and it doesn't matter. There's no way to say that it's true. Well, most people, and I say most, but most people realize that that's false today. That there are there are true things that you can't observe. And some of that stuff comes out of them saying stuff like, we've got these models of the galaxy, and the galaxy is not moving the right way. It's not rotating at the right speed. And they're like, rats, if it's not rotating at the right speed, what does that mean? And what they've said is, though we cannot now observe it, we believe that there is dark matter at the center of the galaxy in great numbers, and maybe supermassive black holes and stuff like that. And so there's one part of science that says, when you see something that doesn't fit the theory, there must be some missing variable. So that's an example, like the rotation of the galaxy, missing variable kind of idea that says, maybe there's a supermassive black hole at the beginning, center of the galaxy, they look for it long enough, and they see now, I think recently, maybe this was in the last couple of years, a set of stars that are orbiting in such a way across the very center of the galaxy that there's clearly something extremely massive at the middle, if the theories that we have are right, that we're basing our observations upon. So it looks like that turned out to be right. So the other side is, are there things that are inaccessible to the scientific method that are still true? So that's a different question. So this is one question. Yes, sir?
I just want to interrupt real quick on dark matter. For anybody who hasn't followed this, this is a crazy, crazy thing out there, right? Because they aren't saying that there's just a little bit of dark matter out there. They're saying, 85%, I think is a rough estimate currently, 85% of the matter in the entire universe has to be this dark matter stuff that we can't see.
So the numbers change a lot.
Right, right,
25%, right. So 5% of the matter, these were the old rough numbers, 5% of the whole universe is the kind of stuff that we're made out of. 25% is dark matter. And dark matter isn't just like this stuff but doesn't have light coming out of it. It's completely different matter, such that if you could build a cup out of dark matter, not only is it invisible, if I threw it through the room, it wouldn't touch anything. It would only interact via gravity, and so it would keep drifting right through the room, not touch anything, and go all the way down to the center of the Earth eventually. So it is a little crazy. And then 75% of the universe is dark energy. So 3/4 of the universe is something, and when you say to the physicists, what is dark energy? They will be very clear with you, usually, and say, we have no idea. It might be the cosmological constant. It might be the vacuum energy of space. It might be blah, blah, blah. They literally, and I've said this, I've been on the record saying this before, it gets people really wound up. Physicists and cosmologists today, if you want to know if there's room for winning in physics right now, and astrophysics and cosmology, physics and cosmology today, the stuff you learned in your textbooks, or maybe in the college level and some of this kind of stuff, that if you answered the question, build a model that works for the universe using the tools that you have developed and said are scientifically accurate. When they do that, 95% of their answer is wrong. These are the professionals and the academics, the people who are grading your papers when they take their theory that they're testing you on, and they say, here's how it all works out. They get on a test, on a scale of 1 to 100, they got a 5% correct. And insist that it's correct. That's the part that gets me, is they will insist that it's correct. This is why I think there's room for huge discovery, is when your predictions are 5% accurate, you ought to at least consider the possibility that you're wrong. And you may be 95% wrong, right? So that is a very important point, and it's something that we'll talk about in the coming weeks as well. But that's a really good point, so thanks for bringing that up. So the idea of science used to mean something, and Lang and I were talking about this earlier. Lang thinks it's a good idea, and unfortunately I'm going to have to take the time to do it, because it's a great idea. We need a sheet of terms that we can publish. Maybe it's a few pages, hopefully it's not a new dictionary. When we say logic, this is what we mean. When we say love, this is what we mean. When we say science, this is what we mean. Science used to mean what it means in Latin. It's scientia, knowledge. So all knowledge, philosophy, historic, all of that was science. There were the natural sciences, there were the metaphysical sciences, there were the philosophic sciences, everything was called science. Now, today, when you say science, we usually mean something very, very narrow. We mean it's something that uses the scientific method, and the scientific method presupposes a set, presupposes only a certain set of the laws of physics. of the laws of the universe. It doesn't, it will not allow you to use certain other theories. So right now, if you're going to use the scientific method and you're going to say, I'm going to use modified Newtonian gravity as an example. I'm going to use a new hypothesis. I'm not going to use standard model. I'm going to use another hypothesis. And you act like you assume that that hypothesis is true, your paper will not get published. They'll say it's pseudoscience. And the reason is, the scientific method is one thing. We all know what the scientific method is. Everybody learned that one. What is getting baked in a lot of times to practically happening in science is, if your scientific method isn't based in the same set of axioms and assumptions that standard models are, then it's considered fringe or pseudoscience, It's very difficult to get published. I'll use IDEA as an example of exactly what we're getting at, although that one's much more controversial. But so I like modified Newtonian dynamics, or the guys who, I don't know if everybody's aware, but Big Bang Theory only really got a grip in the last century, the latter half of the last century. Prior to that, it was eternal universe. The universe is infinitely big, it's eternal, and guys like Hubble believed that the universe was creating, matter was getting created in the centers of galaxies. So they have shots of some of these galactic clusters, like I think NGC 7603 is one that is kind of an example for them, where if you look at the redshift of that particular quasar, it seems to be this side of a galaxy that has a lower redshift. A higher redshift, and this is less redshifted. So it should be way, way, way at the other end of the universe, but it looks like it's closer to us than this one. So that what it would mean is that rule of the further away from us, the faster way it's moving kind of thing, doesn't seem to be true in at least a handful of cases out there. Now, there's some alternate explanations to it, but try to get published today on Hubble's type of eternal universe theory and see how well it goes. Most journals will reject it and say, this is not in line with science. And really what they mean is, it's not in line with our assumptions. Mm. So not only, that's the worst case. If they're really open-minded, that shouldn't matter, right? It should be agnostic to what the assumptions are. As long as you state the assumptions, you use the scientific method, it ought to work. It doesn't work that way in American publications anyway. Now the other side of that though is, if you are going to try to invoke something that is a non-physical law and say that it's an actor, it's an automatic DQ.
Yes.
And we say it's unscientific. Now, what's the problem with that? The problem that Peter's alluding to is this. If the world is this big, and the physical part of the world is this big, and that there is some sort of interaction between the physical part of the world and the non-physical part of the world, and as an example, I'll give you, we can just do it this way for small examples. If the mind really is a real, existing, immaterial thing, and the brain is a physical thing only, if you, this is Dennis, who's not here today, hopefully will come back. Thanks to Carl for reaching out to him and doing a terrific job of doing that. And Ruben's not here, he did a great job too. If you're a scientist today, what position are you stuck with?
The brain.
The brain is all there is, because you don't even allow this to happen.
Right.
So you have to be what's called a monist. You have to be a person who believes that the mind and the brain are the same thing. And they end up with problems that are completely unsolvable and obviously false. So if you're going to do this, you have to. Go ahead.
It's definitional, though. Like, that is the definition. That is the modern, I will absolutely concede modern. That is the modern definition of science.
Right.
So when you like do scientists and you do the quotes with your fingers,
yes.
That is just what science and what scientists are. If you want to have a discussion about philosophy and theology and even psychology to a certain extent, which would irritate psychologists, but you can have that discussion from a theoretical perspective, but the instant you start trying to apply metrics and study brain chemistry, you bake in an assumption that that everything is natural and that God does not reach down and randomly make people happy.
Right, and this is an assumption called methodological naturalism versus philosophical naturalism.
Right.
But the problem is this. Philosophical naturalism means there is said, is a statement, there is nothing other than that which is physical.
Yes.
Methodological naturalism says maybe this stuff is out there.
Right.
But
it cannot be rationally studied and applied, and the scientific method cannot be applied to it.
So here's a problem, and this is maybe what Peter was to which was alluding, and maybe a question for you. What if this is the way it really is? What if the reason the brain does what it does, if there's an immaterial mind poking on it, so to speak, you know, to use it for the problem?
Yeah.
Will science ever come up with the right answer?
No.
Okay. This is the problem.
Science cannot be guaranteed to come up with the right answer.
Right. Right. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
It could. If this is the case, then we know for a fact that it won't come up with the right answer. It can only come up with the wrong answer if it says, I will explain all of why the brain
is doing it. If it says, I will explain everything.
But that's just a circular argument when you're defining science so as to exclude God as irrelevant.
And so that's why he said it's definitional. Now, the question that I would ask is this. Up until 200 years ago, that wasn't the definition.
Was.
So who is right to change the definition on us? Are they right to have done
wrong.
So?
Yes.
Or have we damaged science by doing
yes.
so?
Yes. They're right to have done so.
Okay. No. So that will remain a debate, and we'll get to that one when we get to the next one.
But really, I mean, that
apparently it will also be a debate now.
To the cultural shift within academia, right? I mean, we point to all the Christian scientists of 200 years ago. We look at all the leading physicists today. They're all atheists or agnostics. Most of them are atheists. It's because atheism has taken over academia. 200 years ago, Christianity dominated academia.
Right.
Because Christianity started academia. The Catholic Church started science.
That's true.
For all intents and purposes. So to do this, there's this inherent conflict.
But he's not doing that. But why because? You said because. See?
I'm just pointing out about the cultural shift. I'm not saying who's to blame saying that it was the case. The Christian worldview was the norm within academia for centuries.
Right.
And now in the last 100 years, that's not the case. The atheists have taken over academia and said, we reject the Christian worldview, we reject anything spiritual.
No. They have said, there's no place for spiritual worldview within science. God does not push the planets around like he used to, quote unquote. God used to...
Or angels. Angels.
Angels, God, you know, the planet's motion was caused by supernatural deities, by supernatural
agents. Yeah.
This is not good science. And it never was. And honestly, there was a lot of people in the kind of church scientific community at the time that said, okay, yes, we have to explain it somehow, but this is an unsatisfying. So, as science developed, and it became specialized with its own set of rules that define it now, that do, by definition, exclude supernatural interaction. That's not a reflection on the value of the supernatural or the value of religion.
So all of what
they're
saying,
definition.
Yeah, all of what we're saying is true. The question, the real question we want to ask, and I think maybe the question that Peter is asking, or the part of what Peter's question I found very interesting, is does this help us or hurt us? Does this help us or hurt us?
Well, it's a reflection of the change in people's beliefs, and it's the same for the same reason that our culture is going downhill. That the Western world has been moving from Christianity toward humanism, and so we've changed with science. We've changed paradigms. It's not a discovery. It's a change of beliefs.
So I will say what I don't want to get into is the culture going downhill, because I think you can argue that you see this over time, or courts of renewal, and where they may be coming from, all that kind of stuff. But ultimately, that's not an answer to the question I'm asking. The question I'm asking is, is this a help or a hindrance, or is it a help in some places and a hindrance in others?
It's a
help.
Right. So, and they're both correct in some ways. That is to say, if you are going to say, we don't have to investigate the motion of the planets because we already know how it happens. Angels are pushing it around. then it stops you from doing the rational inquiry that Kepler does, that Newton does, and all that kind of stuff.
Can I interrupt for just a second?
Yes, sir.
When the sun stopped for a day back in Joshua's time, does that mean that all the scientists and everything today say that's a total fallacy and the Bible's not true?
So if that depends on whether you are a believer in methodological naturalism or philosophical naturalism. If you're a philosophical naturalist, you say, that's definitely nonsense.
Yeah, it never happened.
And if you're a methodological naturalist, what you'll say is, we can never discover the mechanism by which that happened because it lies outside the tools.
But weren't computer runs done and stuff that did actually prove that in order for everything to fit the way the timing is right now, there has to be some sort of aberration in the sun stop for a day?
It depends on a set of assumptions on which not everybody agrees.
Well, if that is true, then what he said about science is out to lunch, because God and the angels or whatever could absolutely stop the sun for a day if that happened.
Well, so there's a difference. One is God an interventionist, and he lets it could be this way. There's two ways, maybe two major ways this could happen. One is, the world is, and it's all the Carl Sagan thing. It is, and that's all it ever will be. And so there is no God behind it. And if that's the case, all these things are happening in some either mechanistically or quantum mechanically, which ultimately, in my opinion, still breaks down mechanistically. So you still have some mechanism working there. If there's a God outside that, he could be one of two ways that this God could work, maybe a combination of both. One is, he could have wound it up, like a deist thinks. It's a set of mechanisms. He winds the clock up, and he steps back from it, and he's designed it so well that it can run for billions of years on its own without him touching it. So it doesn't need angels to push it around. The other version is, no, every single thing that happens around here has got some supernatural entity behind it making it happen.
Proactively, continuously making it happen.
Non-stop spiritual intervention in the physical world. Or, and then maybe the junction between the two is, God winds it up, lets it go, but then when he wants to, he reaches in and tweaks it once in a while. And stopping the sun would be a tweak that lets you still have a mechanistic universe, but it uses an interference occasionally. But it's different than what Skyler was saying, which is this idea of people, you know, angels are constantly pushing Mercury around the sun. So in some ways, it's an improvement. So it's an improvement on people who are willing to stop. But let me give you the modern version of that right there. The modern version of angels pushing the planets around the sun. Big Bang Theory. Big Bang Theory, which, by the way, I've used constantly in class, as if you believe in Big Bang Theory, then here's how the Kalam cosmological argument proves that there is a God. So I actually don't think the Big Bang Theory is correct. In fact, I know for a fact it's not correct, and here's how I know. Now, it may have happened in a way like that-ish, but it certainly didn't happen in accordance with those rules. How do we know that? We know that because there are unsolved problems that say, if there are these, you know, we'll say, for argument's sake, these three laws of physics out there. These three laws of physics mean, deductively, that X will happen. What do we see? We observe Y. So this is the problem, is this says X, but Big Bang Theory claims Y. Now, as an example, one of the things that you see out there that have made it into physics, and it's completely, when I say faith-based, I mean completely made up from scratch, with no evidence at all. Zero evidence. They resolve this right now in modern lambda CDM theory, which is the predominant standard model, by calling it inflation. That there was a period of time when the universe was expanding at a certain rate, at the speed of light, and then it jumped many, over 1,000 times the speed of light to another size, and then it slowed down instantaneously to that original speed, and now it's changed a couple times. Whether it's now it's either increased and decreased 11 times, or it's it was decreasing and then it started increasing again recently. But the bottom line is, not only does inflation theory require that you believe that something completely unexplained by the laws of physics, and when I say unexplained, I mean contrary to the laws of physics. These are the laws of physics, and something happened that's completely against the laws of physics in order to make Big Bang Theory work. We also end up with a couple of artifacts from this. Anybody know what they are? What we have to have? You gotta have an inflation field and you gotta have an inflaton. So there's a particle nobody's ever seen. It's a theoretical particle, maybe the entire universe, that is the inflaton particle, and there's an inflation field that has not been observed either. So this is, lest you think science is not faith-based, this is mainstream science. Says the laws of physics tell us this, we observe this, and we're going to make something up that makes it work. And it is exactly the same thing And this is the Eternal Universe guys do a great job of pointing this out. And I think they're wrong too, but ultimately they do a great job pointing out. They're like, this is Ptolemy all over again. This is epicycles, this is Mercury moves backwards, this is nonsense, and it's collapsing under its own weight, and it's ridiculous. We're going to have to, this is my one prediction in the Skylar before he explodes. In 100 years, we're going to look back on this century and say, we walked two steps backwards. Everything that we did from 1905 to 2050 completely took us away from the truth. And we had to, we basically burned physics down to back to Lorentz. We restarted with Lorentz and did it all again. That's my opinion, that's what's going to happen.
But
I don't believe in time either, so you can take my opinion.
But what you're describing is the process of science. Like, that's built into the process of science, is always acknowledging. Because like you said, some of that is faith-based, but when you talk to physicists, they will acknowledge, look, good physicists will acknowledge, we don't have an explanation for this, here's where the assumptions lie, and this is the best theory that we have right now, and we're working towards it, and there's fights within the community, and you know, like you said, sometimes you go as a community, the scientific community goes down the wrong path, reaches the dead end, and then somebody publishes one of those papers that does reset, burns it to the ground. So you can't say, we don't have this 100% right, therefore we've made no progress at all. That's not fair.
So what I would say is this, let's instead grant it, since we put a number on it, let's say that it advances us 5% down the field. The question is, if instead of doing it that way, we did it another way that is easily accessible to everyone, not one that, you know, is so pie in the sky it can't be done, like, let's just fix all the academic environments so that nobody takes any account as to what their own pet theory is or whatever when they do. We know that's not possible because humans are on the board reviewing and all that kind of stuff. Is there another way of doing business that instead of 5% ramps us to 50%? So when we're wrong, we're only half wrong instead of being 95% wrong. Is there a way? And the argument that I'm going to want to make over the next few weeks boils down to this. If you take this from a Christian perspective, point one, and point two, you move at a rate consistent with humility. So what I mean by that is, we will, here's my other way to argue that one. We have scientists that will tell you that they are absolutely convinced that as easily as you can know that the law of gravity operates in here, that there are black holes that do certain things, and this is what information happens when it goes into them, and all blah, 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 blah. And that they can tell you that the universe is 13.77 billion years old, and this is the size of it, and all that kind of stuff. The exact same physicist, cannot tell you why a bicycle stays upright. A physicist who's going to tell you what's going on the other side of the galaxy or the universe cannot tell you why a bicycle stays upright. This is a hubris where we are too willing to believe. So, you know, if you make a prediction that says, I know where a ball's going to land when I throw it, and you're off by a little bit, okay, you feel pretty good about that, especially if you're within a certain margin of error. But you don't turn around and be like, well, it's only off by 5%, but we'll pretend that the universe is ideal. This is what's happening a billion miles away. That is poor rationale. That is bad logic, and it's bad science, in my opinion. So if we moved at a steady rate, if we had done that since 1500, we would be further along now because we may be taking one step forward, but it might take us 50 years to do so. Right now, we're taking three steps forward in 20 years, and then we're waiting 50 years and doing work. And it's taken us another 20 years to figure out what we've done. And in the meantime, we've had to take two steps back. So by the time you do all that math, what you realize, we would be moving twice the speed that we should have been doing if we had done it more slowly, more completely, with less hubris. And why is it? Why is it that the scientific community is saying, this is how the universe began? Why?
Because human nature is to pursue certainty and absolute beliefs.
And they want, and furthermore, and they want an explanation.
Sure.
Everybody wants to. So if the scientist who privately, behind closed doors, ought to tell you this, and some of them will say publicly,
right,
we don't have any idea how the universe began. What is the downside if you're a scientist? There's folks in the church standing there being like, I can tell you exactly how the universe began. God did it. And so on this side, if you want the credibility that you desire, we all desire, and you're a scientist that doesn't believe in that, you have to say, well, we know how it started too, and I can put numbers behind
right.
it. But then you go behind closed doors and we don't actually know how it's going on. But then you come over here to this side and you ask the Christian, you're like, well, then we do know these following things. How come that doesn't match up with the Bible? And what you'll also get on our side as well, we're not really sure about that either. So both sides have room for uncertainty, and that's why I think proper humility in science and religion and theology and doctrine development and all that rationale is a good thing to have. We are not God, we will not all know all this stuff. So this is certainly gone longer than 10 minutes. Yes, and then back to Scott.
So with the inflation thing, how, why is that considered science and not pseudoscience?
That's a great question. The reason it's considered science is, let me defend it for a second, is to say this. When there was debate back in the day on it, there have been theories that have gone in the past where you believe, we say this is what the theory is, here's the hypothesis, and then you get some data that don't fit the hypothesis, and it's unexplicable under the hypothesis, but it's only a handful, and you say, well, we're not going to throw the baby out with the bathwater here, let's figure out, and in 50 years they're like, oh, we didn't know this is correct, but we didn't know to factor also for this, and that's why this is right. That is a different process. It looks very similar too, but it's a different process than saying, well, I'm 95% wrong, but I'm going to keep bludgeoning my way ahead. The reason that nobody has dropped Big Bang Theory is simply this. Everybody knows Eternal Universe Theory is worse, if possible, and there's no other option right now. So you kind of have to go with the only option you've got. So if you're going to fix your, it's a lot of duct tape, but it's the only thing that keeps the plane flying.
The thing about the scientific community is when that better theory shows up and explains more and goes from 5% to 7% or 13%, as long, it's hard when it undercuts a lot of presuppositions and a lot of things that people have built careers on, but eventually, if the scientific process is being followed, which like you said, you're throwing humans in the mix, so there's a challenge there, that should eventually come around to that better theory.
Right.
That's the way it's supposed to work.
So, yeah, and I'll answer that one real quickly. I'll finish Peter's question and we'll move to the next one. So I'll give you a quick argument, and I'll expand on this one for those that don't know the science that I'm talking about when we do the series. An example of what I'm talking about right now is, does everybody have some sort of, at least know what quantum mechanics is based on their academic career? You know, you had to, if you're our age or older than we are, that kind of stuff, it wasn't taught a lot, but now it's taught a lot in school, so you at least hear about it, you'll see some basic stuff about it. If you go to college and take any kind of physics, you will learn something about quantum mechanics. The stuff that you learn in college textbooks is almost always articulated in the terms of something called the Copenhagen interpretation of what quantum mechanics is. And so they'll say things like, I think everybody's probably heard this one, the dual split experiment. Here you are, and an electron goes through two holes, and it interferes with itself and causes an interference pattern. And this is completely inexplicable, so what we believe, and then they turn around and tell you an interpretation. So what actually happens is, and it's hard to believe, but the electron actually goes through two slits at the same time if you don't observe it. That's what you'll hear taught in classrooms. It's complete nonsense. It's completely wrong. Big name physicists still say it today, but when you go to an academic department and you learn in the postgraduate side of the house what's actually going on, nobody believes Copenhagen interpretation. Nobody. This is 100 years ago, interpretations. De Broglie Bohm theory, also popularly called pilot wave theory, explains all of it. And if we had started on, and I think it's wrong too, but if we started on De Broglie Bohm and we had said, this explains everything, and the electron doesn't have to go through two spaces at the same time, then it would have actually gotten us more quickly to the answer, which is in a direction. Obviously, if I had the answer, I'd be sitting in the Nobel Perception Committee thing. But it just, I think it's headed in the right direction, and we have wasted 100 years by following the wrong interpretation. And here's the hot ticket: that interpretation existed because it was the most counter-theistic position out there. Of the interpretations. And people in the scientific community that did not like theism embraced it because it said, it very much suggested that God was not a part of this equation. And my point is this, your philosophical assumptions will affect your science, period. They affected Einstein, they affect us. And if they're right philosophical assumptions, your science is going to be right sooner. If they're wrong philosophical assumptions, you're going to have to take, you may be taking 3 steps backward and 2 steps forward. Okay, Scott.
I'm good.
Peter. And then Al.
So, I mean, we're kind of, it seems like some things that cannot be observed are considered science. Some things that are, that cannot be observed are considered pseudoscience. And if people can make a hypothesis and observe something else and kind of assume that this thing that cannot be observed happens, then, and if that is following the scientific method, if that is observing it in some way, and if that is considered science, then why wouldn't all world religions be considered science? Or
right.
All
so
kinds of things that are observable.
The problem is this, is that people will basically turn around and say, if you can put math behind it, then it's true. That, if I could say it in a sentence, that's what the physics belief is. If you can put math behind it, then it's true. So, or it could, maybe, well, that's not right. If you can put math behind it, it could be true. If you can't put math behind it, then it certainly is not true. That's maybe the better way to say it. So why the completely ad hoc doesn't have a law of physics that explains the inflation field works as science is because they can say, well, I can describe that mathematically. Okay, so does that mean it's true? And they'll be like, well, not necessarily. But we know that everything that is true can have math put behind it. That's what physicists believe today. They have come to this conclusion that the mathematical world is maybe the deeper world. So if I was going to do this back in Plato's time, remember how I keep saying that we haven't actually advanced past the Greeks? This is Platonic ideal. What the physics world today believes is there's an ideal world. It's described by mathematics, and everything else we see is shadowed world based on this ideal world. Now, it's not perfectly analogous to what Plato was saying, but it's the same idea. So we actually haven't advanced in those 3,000 years at all, philosophically. We're still asking the same question, and we're doing it differently.
Well,
doing it with more math.
Max Tegmark, you know, one of the leading cosmologists today, just released a book in the last 2 years, Our Mathematical Universe, where he actually adopts the old Platonic view and says the math is what's real, everything else about our universe is fake.
That's an interesting point, though, because anytime we have this discussion, it's always religion versus science. And science gets kind of wound up in astrology and astronomy and physics. But nobody ever goes, well, you know, God interferes in math. Like, nobody ever goes, well, 2 + 2 = 4, except when God is involved, and then sometimes it's, like...
Physicists don't say that, but theists do. Theists will say you can take 2 loaves and 2 fish. No. 5 loaves and 2 fish and end up with 12 baskets. So 2 + 2 = 17 in this case. So they do say that. Now, we can put math behind that. Now, the question is, if you actually said, well, here's the
Jesus
volume
constant
of,
behind it, you know,
right.
Whatever.
Yeah, constant J. And unfortunately, apparently the J is a time-dependent equation, too.
Right.
So it's a wave function.
If he would have
been
longer,
4,000, it's X
right.
amount. If you speed 5,000, it's Y amount. So
right.
it's not a linear regression.
So it's not 2 + 5 = 17. It would be 2 + 5 + Jesus = 17.
Yeah, well, that'd be maybe multiplied by a J factor, and the question you'd have to answer, what percent of the basket was fish parts versus bread parts, in order to be able to answer that. So we're short on data, or we couldn't do that equation. But yeah, people do say that, and that's my point is, and this is why I like that Miracles book, that by whomever, somebody knows it.
Taxes?
I like that one too.
Oh, okay.
There's a recent guy who put out a book that catalogs 1,000 miracles or more out there. And his point isn't these miracles are all true. His point is, don't tell me science is accounting for all the data. There's a bunch of data out there for which science is not accounting. So stop ignoring this data and explain it. If the explanation is mass hallucinations, if the explanation is power of suggestion, whatever, do it. But explain the data. And what his point is there's plenty of evidence of miracles. You're just ignoring it. You're not doing your science on it. Because you automatically said, well, if somebody claims to have seen the following thing, then they are hallucinating without bothering to look at it. And Dennis isn't here, so I'll talk about him briefly, but when Dennis was sitting in my study at one point, and I asked him, we were having exactly this discussion, what evidence would be sufficiently compelling? What do you not rule out? I finally got it down to, Jesus appears in front of both of us. He tells you who he is. He answers any and all questions you ask him for the period of 10 minutes, and you can physically touch him, and he shows you the wounds in his hand and the wound in his side. Would you believe at that point? This is Jesus personally appearing to him. By the way, I think we had him levitating in the meantime as well. Personally appears to him, yeah. Answer, takes water glass, hands the wine back, the whole night, right? Dennis's answer, what do you think?
No,
I would not believe it. And so then I said, well, he goes, you and I could be hallucinating that. I said, that's right, we could be. How many external witnesses would you want? He goes, I'd have to have other people that also witnessed it. I was like, how many do you want? 12? 500? And he heard the click of the weapon go off a safe in the ambush. And so his answer at that point was, I don't know, I don't want to talk about it anymore. Now, I'm picking on Dennis. We as Christians do the same thing sometimes in defense of our own beliefs. So this isn't just atheists and agnostics that do it. Sometimes somebody will attack our beliefs and we say, I can't explain it and I'm going to shut my brain down and stop thinking about it because it might be that what I believe is false and I don't want to do that. So not just Dennis, us too. But that is the scientific attitude right now towards miracles. And it also represents in a lot of Christians the Christian attitude towards science. And what I want to say over the next couple of weeks, and maybe I'll end the question this way, we will find where the happy medium is, and by the end of a couple of months, we'll be better scientists and we'll be better Christians, or at least we'll know how to do those two things. And that's the hope for what we're doing. Okay.
I was going to say, when you were talking about, you're talking about the Big Bang, which I don't believe in, I was going to say it's not partly faith-based, it's entirely faith-based. In order to derive empirical knowledge, there are those metaphysical assumptions that you have to make about
right.
reality. And if those assumptions are correct, then you're good. And that really is the key. That's really, it's
if
not about...
If the assumptions
about,
are correct, then you could be good. You can still go wrong.
Yeah, you
have to have those right in order to be good.
Yeah, and so really it's what's changed in the scientific community is it's changed from having a Christian theist paradigm to having a naturalist paradigm. It's
what I'll say, and here's, so I think Al's actually exactly right, but I'll tell you why I think that works, why that works. And what he's saying is this, if you're a physicist today and you're going to go do your work in pick some really abstract, difficult to understand, narrow part of physics. You don't even actually know, so let's say that you're a guy who's working on black hole theory. You have to know relativity really well. You have to know Newton's laws of gravity really well. You probably don't know enough, you don't know anything about fluid dynamics. Actually nowadays you gotta learn a little bit about fluid dynamics. You probably don't know much about some portions of optics, so when you get to what happens optically, you go to another physicist that knows about that. You end up knowing this very narrow thing, and why? The answer why is the amount of stuff that we know today, or at least claim to know today, and in reality it's both, is so vast that it's a single person cannot even reasonably begin to dent it. So the reason that people, and has anybody read Hawking's book, either The Grand Design or Brief History of Time, or at least parts of it? All right. Hawking makes mistakes in that book that a first-year philosophy student would not make when he's talking philosophy. And the reason is, this genius, who's smarter than everybody in the class probably put together, doesn't know anything about the actual discipline. So he knows portions of physics better than any of us ever will, but he knows nothing about philosophy. But he's trying to answer philosophical questions. And when he does, he looks like a noob. And so does... And that's why William Lane Craig, who knows very little about the physics, like if you asked him, write me an equation on physics on the board, he'd probably be out after two if he got that right. He might get FMA, and that's it. So he goes to his experts about that, but he knows philosophy really well, he knows logic really well, and as a result, a guy that knows nothing about science owns these guys continually in debate. That's because of what Al says. all of the science is actually based in philosophy, but most people, almost nobody studies both. And here's the danger. Most people don't realize it. Most people don't realize that what their scientific beliefs are, specifically about laws, certain scientific laws, are based in philosophical assumptions. As an example, all the physics you know today, that you see today, in fact, even the way that we calculate for GPS satellites, is based in a couple of assumptions that are axioms. The laws of physics are constant and frame independent. And secondly, that the speed of light is the same from point A to point B as it is from point B to point A. Those two things are true. We don't know that those are true. We have no idea. No idea. Zero. And we can never know if that's the case. Probably.
But it doesn't matter because my phone tells me where I am.
Yeah, now the question
is... In that example,
right.
It does not matter because functionally I get what I want. So there's a philosophical component to it, I get it. If that was the point of it, was to answer a philosophical question, yes. If the point of it is to put a constellation of GPS satellites that let me navigate around Northern Virginia without getting lost, check.
Right, and it has to do with purpose. Now, the problem is some guys will say, but that is it is true. And the idea is, right. It might actually be wrong. What might actually be happening
is... It might be close enough.
It might be close enough.
Right.
So, but remember what we're talking about, yes. So if we're talking about the fundamental laws of the world, though, that's... People are making claims about the fundamental laws of the world when they ought to be doing engineering problems. And this is my major... Any time a physicist is like, well, look, our science put people on the moon. I was like, no, false. Engineering put people on the moon.
Right.
Science did not. Newton's laws put men on the moon. With the calculation of power, do you know what the calculating power of the Apollo 11 mission command module was? What it's analogous to? TI-85 calculator.
Right.
Is more powerful than the thing that put men on the moon. So don't tell me science put men on the moon. Newton put man on the moon. Kepler put man on the moon. And a TI-85 calculator did. And a bunch of good engineers.
Right.
That's what did it. And unless you think that the Russians, they build huge rockets. We build smaller rockets because the Russian calculating method was point rocket at moon, keep tracking on moon. And you need not three times. You need a bunch more fuel to do it that way than if you take the shortcut like the Americans do. This is why we got there first. Part of why we got there first. Okay. That was a lot more on the science-y stuff. Thank you, Peter, for being the guy that takes us off topic. Deeply into topics.
Yeah.
Steve, you had a follow-up question at the end of the second hour last time, and I have honestly forgotten the spin that you put on it. So can you repeat it?
I had this question of motivation. What is the motivation that Khan has for his thoughts?
Where is the motivation, or what is the motivation?
Well, just motivation in general. Does Khan have any motivation to love us? Do we have any motivation to love Khan? Do we have any motivation to obey? Why should we become a Christian? Is there some motivation that causes us to become a Christian?
All right, and so. Very good question. Does God have a motivation? What is it? Where does our motivation come from? And this is actually a variation on some of what we were talking about last time, but it's a really good way to put the question. What does motivation mean? What is this word right here?
Move.
This is the root word of move. So, and motivation is basically that which. So that which moves. So that which moves us. So really, even just using, and this is why the definition thing is so important, just using that word. Have you ever heard another language? And I was thinking Finnish particularly, if anybody's familiar with Finnish.
Yeah.
Sometimes there's somebody in here who's all into lutefisk and they're like, yeah, I know all about it because I'm from Minnesota and we still eat this terrible, terrible food. When you look at their language and you translate it directly into English, you're like, morons clearly speak this language. Because the name of like a fishing rod would be stick with reel for fish. Like when you actually do the whole word out or set of words that it means, you know. And we're like, what a bunch of morons. When we turn around and look at our language, when you actually break it out into the Latin and Greek, things like fishing reel means wire wrapped around, reel. Wire wrapped around wheel for fish. So it means exactly the same thing. We just Latin it up, and now all of a sudden it's better. The words that we use automatically carry with them philosophy. Motivation. When you say, what is my motivation? What you're saying, what the question you're really asking is, what is it that's moving me to do this? What does that automatically seem to imply? Something external to you that's moving you to do this thing. So, and I'm not saying that Steve was making this claim, but I'm just saying, if we don't understand the words we're asking, we're automatically baking an answer into them. So here's the question is, what is it that moves us to do something? Now, what Steve really means by motivation, based on the context in what he was using, is what is there something within us that is us, that causes us to, that is the source of our want? Are we the source of that which we desire? Are we the source of what we want? Are we the source of what we hope, what we dream, what we want, what we need? Or maybe not what we need. Are we the source, or is there some other source? And his question here is, does God have a motivation? Is this? Is God the source of the feeling that he has towards us, love? Or is love some higher thing that God is sort of obedient to? It's, what's it, anybody remember the dilemma that this speaks to? Euthyphro dilemma, which is, let's talk about love in moral terms. Let's say love is the morally right thing to do, and hate is the morally wrong thing to do. Let's pretend that's the case. Towards a given object, towards Al. So it's right for God to love Al. It would be wrong for God to intentionally be cruel to Al wantonly. Let's say those two things. Is that truth true because God says it so? Or is that truth true because it is true and therefore God says it? Now the problem with the last part is obvious. God's obeying a higher law. And if God's obeying a higher law, then there's something higher than God. And who set that one? Because that's the real God, whoever set that one. If the first part is true, is it true just because God says so? Then it sounds subjective. Like God could have been like, well, I made it that way. That being nice to Al is good and being cruel to Al is bad. But I could have switched it around. I could have said being cruel to Al is good and being nice to Al is bad. The Christian answer to this one is to say there's a third option. You're not on the horns of a dilemma. There's a third option. And this speaks directly to Steve's question. Or rather, it will make you want to ask Steve's question after you hear the answer. The answer to it is neither. God loves because that is his nature. That is his nature. So it is what is godly to do. Now the problem with that is it leaves us with, the reason it's not a satisfying answer for everybody is it leaves us with this question is, why is God's nature that way? We can express that for those that like the philosophy side in terms of necessity. Well, if God is a maximally great being, then this is the way that he would do business. But necessity sounds like it's imposing something from the outside on God. So where does this motivation come from? Now, what I will note for you is this. The question of what motivates us, or what is it that is the source of our desires, and what is it that's the source of God's desires, is an identical question. If you believe in free will, if you're a determinist, then one of those is easy. Which one's easy? If you're a determinist, if you think that everything is set, that you don't have free will, what's the source of your motivation, your desire, and your want? God is. He programmed you, right? So, boom. Carl's going to want to do this, Mason's going to want to do that, Lang's going to want to do this, and Al's going to want to do that. And I set those things, and that's the way that they're going to be. God set those things, that's the way they're going to be. It leaves us with the question of, does God have free will, and does he set them? So that deterministic question at least answers one for you. But here's my point to you, and here's why I believe in free will. Here's not why I believe in free will. Here's an interesting consequence of believing in truly free will. Now, I've said it before, but I'll say it again here, and let's discuss it a little bit to see if it addresses Steve's point. Your will is just as free as whose?
God's.
There is no difference in the amount of freedom that your will and God's will has. You can, and my example is, who's the, Jean Grey, is that the X-Man?
Yep.
Okay. Jean Grey at some point, if not in the movies, in the comic books, which I've read, either destroys the universe and puts it back together, or bottom line is she becomes powerful enough to have done that.
Yep.
The only, so you'll note that people can want to destroy the whole universe. And if they had the power to do so, maybe they would. Think of, a rot young man when the girl that he likes doesn't like him back kind of thing. And, you know, he's like, I'd destroy the whole universe if I could. And then you wait a week and he's falling in love with somebody else. This desire was unbounded. There was no limit to what you can desire. The only limit is to what you can do. And that's the difference between you and God, is he's powerful enough to do whatever he wants to do. And thank goodness he doesn't have that kind of caprice that the teenage boys have, and everybody else. So if that's the case, what do you think? Where does God's motivation come from? And where does ours come from? Because what I'm saying is, if will, that which moves us, we've already said from definition last time, is our will. And we'll say, free. And I'll say yes. So free will is what motivates us. What is it?
It sounds like a combination between desires and choices.
Okay, and we talked, so you weren't here last time. We did talk about what desire was like. I told the story of the people that were in the factory, that they went home after a week and they sent them a bunch of Sears catalogs and they're all back to work the next day kind of thing. You don't have desires until you're presented with a choice. So I don't desire, right now, let's say you don't know about it, but there are two kinds of drones out there, one of which will automatically fly itself around wherever you want, and the other one you have to radio control. And now that you know about the two, you want the first one and not the second one, or whatever. You didn't even have the desire until then. So you don't get a desire until there's an object or set of objects around which to wrap your desire, so to speak, and actually you don't have a desire until that thing that you see suggest to you at least two courses of action, either buy A or buy B, or be nice to A or hate A, that kind of thing. So until you have an external object, there is no desire. What's an interesting consequence of that, if that's true?
The more objects, the more struggle.
Bingo, that's one. That's a very practical level. What's the opposite end of that one? God by himself, no creation yet.
That is the most, there's nothing to desire.
The Buddhist definition of God comes to complete fulfillment in God without the universe. God exists sans desire because he doesn't have anything that he needs or wants. And Augustine would tell you, because God is pure actuality, that the second that he desired it, the creation, it was here. Simultaneous desire and will. So that's an extension of omnipotence. And the reason we don't have that is because we act in time. And God does not act in time. Or did not originally have to act in time, maybe to say. That's my definition of time.
So God is not actually motivated. He is innately. He can't, almost by definition, God cannot be motivated in the human sense of that word, because it would be external. He can be innately and loving, and that can be a character trait, but he can't have that imposed on
him. In fact, I would say that's exactly right.
Are you saying God doesn't have desires?
What we're saying is the desires that we see, that description that I gave you of I see this, then I want it, what is baked into that assumption? So I said, What was the articulation that I gave you in my drone example that was baked into that assumption? It's a problem for us, it's not a problem for God.
We don't know of it.
Exactly. I said, you don't know about this yet, but once you do, then X. So what is it that God doesn't know about?
Right.
Well, the answer would be nothing. So,
okay. Yeah. That's why I didn't think that would work with God. But I sound like, maybe you're saying the Buddhist thinks that, or...
And I didn't mean to say Buddhism is true, and Buddhism came the world. What I meant to say is the Buddhist concept is the way to enlightenment is to clean yourself of all desires because it'll make you the best you can possibly be. Now, actually, in God's case, we would say that's true, because desires for the Buddhist are things that I kind of want or need. God, we can say, just is, and who he is someone who is loving. But I think, like I said in some other classes, it doesn't make sense for God to love at that time something that doesn't exist. So if there isn't somebody there, if you don't exist, God doesn't love you because you do not exist. God loves things that you can only love something that exists, is the assumption. So this is where you have to get across that temporal and atemporal boundary. You have to talk about transcendence and all that kind of stuff. But ultimately, it's hard to talk about God without the universe, because what's the case? There is a universe. So it isn't God without the universe. It's God and the universe is the way we have to think about all these things. So that's baked into it as well.
Yeah, I always thought it was kind of ironic with Buddhism just being, we don't need anything, in this world that's extra, that kind of thing. But the guy, the statue, he always looks very, very well fed, and
Yeah, that's a fair point. Yeah, is desire a good thing or a bad thing? I think the obvious, if you're a Christian, then God gave you the capacity to desire things. So it has to be good.
But it's desire for the right things,
which is, exactly.
I mean, this whole discussion, you talk about things that never change, the monastic existence of, the early church. This is exactly what you're describing, where the only things that they had were each other and kind of the love for one another and the reflection in the Word of God. That's it. That's all these societies had.
Yes. Yes. Now, and so let me run down this line very quickly, and it'll end in something that's personally galling to me, which is backing up something in the poster child for Reformed theology has said today. In fact, the title of his book, which is the best title of a book ever, and I can't believe he's got it already. It irks me. Why do we want the jobs that we have? Let's say, or maybe let's generalize it. Why do you want a six-figure salary instead of a $10,000 a year job? Why?
Because we think it will make us happier.
Right, and let's say practically speaking,
sure,
it's greater amounts of money. Yes. Right, so we desire some things that are greater. Do we desire to be noble, or do we desire to be base? We desire to be noble because being noble is greater. But what is if what we desire is only that which is greater, that is to say, given any two options, A and B, if A is greater than B, we always want A. What's the exception to that? Give me a rule, give me any example that's an exception to the rule of we want something greater.
Pain.
Pain? Okay, we're great as a measure of pain. But pain is just well-being in a negative direction. Right. So I'm going to get around it that way. Okay, but we would say pain is a lesser thing than is well-being. So pain, that is really maximizing the negative, or maximizing that which is lesser already. All right, but I mean, between two options, like, would you ever choose pain? Would you choose a greater pain, or a deeper pain, a worse pain? Maybe we say worse pain.
Well, temporarily, that's rapid.
And how we talk about pain, we say this pain was worse than that pain. We never say this pain was better than that pain. By better, I meant a greater amount. But why would we ever accept a greater pain?
Because there's a trade-off. It's worthwhile.
Right. And what we're maximizing is which of the two choices. One of these choices brings you greater pain, but it accomplishes something better. So we're still choosing the greater thing. It just, this one happens to bring more pain with it than this one. But overall, we rated this one a 5 and this one a 4, and we chose the 5. So I will tell you that we always choose the greater thing. What's the greatest thing in the universe? If God is the greatest thing in the universe, right, and I'm going to now cheat and go to John and say God is love, so we'll put those two together. If God's the greatest thing in the universe, what ought we desire? It's a no-brainer. It's a complete no-brainer. You desire God. Who wrote the book Desiring God? Darn that guy, John Piper. Yes, you got me.
Can I go back on something?
Yeah, I want to go further down that point, but yes, please.
Okay. We were talking about God in the beginning, sort of before creation. And I think one thing to keep in mind is that Trinity still existed at that point. So a lot of the things that we might think it's got to be somehow lonely or more inaccurate thoughts along those lines are not applicable because Trinity did exist at that time.
Right, so that's a total other discussion. We've had parts of that here before.
Yeah.
And don't,
I beg you
don't get me started on that one because everybody here knows we'll tell them in the class. But that's a great point. All this is interesting, but we still haven't answered Steve's question, have we? Where does this motivation, this desire come from? So in the case of humans, we'll say, well, some of that comes from when we are presented with a choice. But God doesn't seem to be presented with choices. But we'll say one choice that God presented himself with. One choice God presented himself with. What would that have been?
Create or not.
Yeah, to be or not to be. It's a Hamlet's thing. Does he create the world or does he not create the world? Well, he chose to create the world, let's say it that way. Why did he choose to do that? Is God choosing that which is greater over that which is lesser? Now, is it greater to have a world of free beings that love him, et cetera, and are in relationship with him? Or is it greater to have nothing? Which do you think? It seems to me kind of, yeah, I know, it's right. Because you might be asking the question, Dan's question, well, this world came with a lot of pain. But is it worth it? If love, we believe love is worth it. We tell fairy tales about how worth it love is, right? People will go through all manner of hell in order to get to that one person that they love, even if they're living in this kind of barely there relationship with each other kind of thing, right? So we do believe that love is great. We do believe that things are worth paying. We do believe that love is a good enough good to overcome almost an infinite amount of evil in some cases. So we can see why God might make that choice. Now, Steve's question that he's probably thinking I'll ask for him is, does God have a choice in choosing that one? And if what we're saying is that's who God is, what we're saying is the reason that God even thinks of the choice, Now, here's why. Here's the difference. We think of the choice because we get presented something from the outside. Here's the woman that I'm going to marry someday. Here's the guy that I'm going to be a friend with. Here's this part of the kingdom that I can pursue or not pursue. Here's this career I can choose or not choose. We get presented with these options and then we do it. God presents it to himself. So it's him creating it in his mind and then actualizing it. This is why God is different than we are. Is because in reality, we don't actually truly create. We rearrange. God does it from zero. This is the difference between, this is why we're not God. Because God can do it from zero, among other things. But that's a key foundation. Yes, Steve?
So, when thinking about this in the context, what's the difference between Adam and Jesus? Like, Adam had some, obviously, Adam made a different decision than Jesus.
Yes.
What happened?
Well, I think, so in my mind, I've explained this before when I did the here's world A and here's world B thing. And I did this when agnostic to why people choose things. I just said certain people end up choosing certain things in certain situations. And so world A was you create Adam and he goes this way, and world B, maybe God creates Bob, and Bob does the right thing. And as a result, Bob has these people, and so you end up in this world with five people who came to love God, know and love God. And in this world, all this other stuff happens, and you end up, and I'm just gonna make it up, we're making up numbers now. You come up with 10 people who choose to be with God, and versus five people. And maybe there's, you know, another how many that choose not God. And maybe in this world nobody chooses not God, or more probably I would say maybe some other number as well of people that choose not God. And I would say that this number is almost irrelevant. Let's pretend that in God's calculus that this set of numbers of people that don't choose him is irrelevant. That this is done to maximize the number of people that choose a relationship with him. If, and I'm not saying this is the case, but if that's the way that God did business, if that's how he actualized the world, then what he could have done is put Adam in the garden or put Bob in the garden. But he put a guy in the garden that he knew would freely choose to do the wrong thing, so that he ended up with the result, the optimal result. Well, he could have put a guy in the garden that he knew would choose the right thing freely, and end up with a suboptimal result. So as God, as optimizer, if that's the way that this works, then you can see why God has a reason to put a guy in there who he knows is going to do the wrong thing. Is God responsible for this evil? Did he make Adam do it? No, Adam freely chose it. But he actualized that world by putting this mind into that first body. Maybe a different way of saying it is the two minds. This could have been the same body, but he puts either the mind of Adam, the mind that we call Adam, or the mind that we call Bob, he could have put either one of those into that brain. And when he put the mind that we call Adam into that brain, this is what results. So what's the difference between this and Jesus? Well, Jesus is the mind, specifically God's mind, that is put into a brain. And when you put that mind into the brain, he chooses and always chooses to do right. Because that's who God is. That's who that mind is. That mind is a mind that chooses to do right all the time. It's the mind. It's the divine mind. Bob is a might be a mind that chooses to do right all the time too. Doesn't make him divine, just means he's one that freely chooses to do right all the time. Maybe he chooses to do right 99% of the time. Maybe Adam chooses to do right 30% of the time. Figure out in your own mind, how often, and when moral questions come up, how often do you do the right thing? Of 10 moral issues you encounter each day, how many times do you do what you think the right thing is? Maybe if you're feeling particularly convicted, you'd say, well, maybe it's like one time in 10 I do the right thing. Maybe if you are scaring yourself a little bit, like, I don't want to be a legalist, but I'd say like 9 times out of 10 I do the right thing. Nobody ends up saying I do the right thing all the time. Maybe a handful of people do. I'm not one of those people. If we're being honest, nobody really believes they do the wrong thing all the time. Because even if you say that, you'd be like, well, I never do the right thing. I will watch you do something somewhere where you'll smile because you have done something good for somebody else. And you deep down in your heart know that was a good thing to do. So you do the right thing sometimes, you do the wrong thing sometimes. Those percentages, if this is all right, if this all comes kind of out of the mind, certain minds choose different percentages in different circumstances. So the context of what's the difference between Adam and Jesus is the mind that we call the I am always chooses to do the right thing. Because that's who he is. The mind that we call Scott only chooses to do the right thing 37% of the time. Because that's who he is. Now the real question, that's an interesting question. The more interesting question is, can the mind that we call Scott move from 37% to 50% to 75%? Or where do we really want to move? We want to move where the mind of Scott chooses 100% of the time. Let this mind be in you, which is also in Christ Jesus, who, taking on the form of a servant, did not consider equality with God a thing to be grasped. Did not consider equality with God a thing to be grasped. And taking on the form of a servant was what? How did he do it? What did that mindset do for him? Became obedient. Obedient to the point of death on a cross. How does Adam become like Christ? How does Steve become like Christ? How does Scott become like Christ? You adopt the mindset. The mindset is a way that a mind is set. Now, I'm going to set my mind on those settings. For those of you that know settings, the settings menu in the iPhone software of your mind can be toggled. I'm going to have the mindset of this world. I'm going to have the mindset of RBC. I'm going to have the mindset of an engineer. I'm going to have the mindset of whatever. Toggle it to the mindset of Christ. And when you do, you will find yourself, unlike Adam, unlike Scott, choosing the right thing instead of the wrong thing. What's the key to the mindset? When you flip the switch, what's that switch actually say? It doesn't say Jesus mind versus Scott mind. What does the switch say? Do I choose to obey that which I have already said I believe is the greatest good? What's the greatest thing? We just said it in this class, God. What did John Piper say? Desire God. When I flip that switch, it says desire what God's will wants, not what any of this tells me I want. Desire what God's want. Is it unnatural to do so? Absolutely not. Here's why. You already said you know on it. You already said the following things. I want the greatest good. God is the greatest good. I desire that which is greatest. Always. God is greatest. Therefore, what? I desire God. I mean, how hard is that? That's a deductive argument. That is not hard. What's the difference? Why don't we, if it's so easy, how come we're not always doing what God says? Why? Tell me.
Because we've been given sinful desires that are in competition.
Let's say that's not the case. Let's say somebody hasn't imposed it on us. Let's pretend for a second, because I've argued against that and said, we have not been given a sin nature. Sinful desires may be presented to us, but those same sinful desires were presented to God. Turn these stones to bread. Throw yourself from the point of the temple. Bow down and worship. He was tempted with food when he was starving for 40 days, with recognition of who he was. Just people recognizing that he was the Messiah. That's all Satan was saying was, just show him the truth. That Satan's temptation to jump off the top of the temple wasn't let's base jump. That was not his point. His point was, you're the Messiah, you know it, I know it. Everybody here would be better if you just show them. Show them who you are. Why was Jesus not on that program? Anybody know?
Self-glorifying.
Maybe. Yeah, I would say maybe, but if he's God, then there's nothing really wrong with that, right? Because that he would be the right object of glory. Why else might it be? Why was it? It wasn't whose plan?
It wasn't God's plan.
It wasn't the Father's plan. It's not the Father's plan for a reason. What's the reason? Maybe. Maybe something like this. Maybe jumping off the temple gets you less people than doing it the way they did it. I don't know. But God does. So let's say that it's something like that. Why do we not take this deductive logical argument at face value and just desire what God wants?
Because we doubt God. We doubt.
It's a lack of the word in Hebrews, faith. There's something here that we don't believe. It's not that we don't believe. Actually, there are a couple things here sometimes we don't believe. Sometimes we don't believe God is the greatest good. Sometimes we believe what we want really defines the greatest good. This is us trying to be that one horn of the Euthyphro dilemma and define what is good. Subjectively, whatever makes me feel best is good. But then we say, well, wait a minute. If God loves me and he wants me to be happy, then doesn't he want me to feel best? Here's the problem. What if God's job for you in heaven is to be the janitor? Do you want that? Most people will say in their heart, no, I don't want that. I want to be, what did the brothers say?
Sitting right.
Mom comes up and is like, grant that these boys will sit at your right and your left hand when you come into your kingdom. And he's like, can they drink the cup from which I'm going to drink? And they're like, what did they say? We can do it. And they did. They both got killed. Be careful what you ask for. We want to rule. We all make Satan's mistake. I will ascend to the Most High. I will sit on the throne of heaven. I will do these things. That is why I said at the end of last time that all will boils down to this. I want God to be God, or I want to be God. And it's in degrees. Okay? Well, no, I want God to be in charge in heaven. I want him to run the place. But if he thinks that I'm going to be a janitor, you know, let me at least advise him on what would be best for me. Right? That's a lack of faith. Because if God really loves us, what does he know about you and about being a janitor? You will be happier in no... You'll be no, you, being a janitor in heaven will be the happiest that you can possibly be. Being a ruler in heaven would not make you happy in the long run. If you don't think that's the case, by the way, study anybody who's ever gained power ever and see how happy they are.
But even like what you're describing is not isolated to us. This is even Jesus struggled with this. My God, why have you abandoned me? Mm-hmm. Like, this is an understandable thing. Now, his is under more extreme circumstances than most of us are faced with, but the expressing doubt in God's plan is there.
Let me defend Jesus. I'm glad to do this. Okay. I finally get to do this, something I like to do. What was his question? My God,
why did you forsake me?
Why? The why isn't. I don't think
you've got to be kidding.
Here's why. The why matters.
He cried out.
My God, why does it have to be this way? Why have you forsaken me? Why have you left me? Is it necessary for, I do not understand as a human Jesus, maybe he doesn't know all of this.
I do not understand.
Right. I don't understand why you're doing this. It is a crying out for an explanation. Let me put it this way. You are running. Let me tell you why I don't run marathons. This is exactly why I don't run marathons. I will hit mile, I'm going to say mile 18. In reality, it's mile 11. Let's pretend it's mile 18 for my own ego. I'm going to hit mile 18. And you know what the question is that goes on in my head?
Why am I doing this?
What is the benefit that I gain from this? And at mile 18, I start to realize truth. And realizing truth when you're running a marathon is brutal. Because there is no good reason to run a marathon ever. The first guy that did it died. Should have walked. The result would have been the same in either case, okay? No good reason to run a marathon. I'm being a little tongue-in-cheek, right? There is a good reason to run a marathon. There's no good reason for me to run a marathon. So I'm running the marathon, and I realize a few things. Mile 18, I realize the things that I desire are not fulfilled by what I'm doing right now. And the level of pain has increased to the point where my philosophy is coming into contact with my reality. And what I ought to do is stop. Now, what is it that makes me continue a marathon?
Ego.
Unfortunately, it's that. Exactly. So now, for me, running marathons is bad. Because the only motivation to do it well is to adopt the wrong motivation. There's something to think about in your own personal philosophy and why I don't run marathons.
So, I'll also defend Jesus. Because if he doubted on the cross, then he did what Adam did and runs. Nothing was accomplished. So there was no doubt on the cross. It's also a direct quote into the Psalms.
Yes.
So he really wasn't asking. I believe he was not asking a question. He was. Yeah, he was pulling out. It was actually more for us.
So if he's doing that, problem solved, absolutely. And I think Scotty would agree with that. But let's say that the question is legitimate.
I do agree with that. I think that is a strained reading of, that is not the plain text reading. That is a very interpretive reading.
And it may be. All messianic prophecy, if it's messianic prophecy, it's certainly not plain text. It's very unusual.
Yes.
So back to your question, though, is if this. So here I am at mile 18, and I'm asking the question, why? Because what am I looking for? What am I looking for? What do I need between mile 18 and mile 26? I need what?
The motivation.
Motivation. I need motivation. And if what I knew was this, let me tell you something different. When I was doing the Marine thing and I was running missions, if you made me move some of the distances that I did on a real mission, on training, halfway through it, I'm like,
never have.
When I'm actually doing the mission, no fatigue. No desire to quit. Fatigue, no desire to quit. Because I know why I'm doing it. Now, the walk back is always terrible because I'm like, couldn't they just put helicopters in here? The helicopter guys are like, the LZ's not safe. I'm like, there's 80 of us here. It's safe. Anyway, it's the walk back that always got me. So the walk in was always a problem. It was never a problem when you have a mission and you know why. When you know why. If you don't know why and you are ex cruciatus, you're in the most pain that the Romans can devise and they were really good at it. You want the mile 18 to mile 26.2 motivation. And Jesus was looking for that motivation to pull through the end. One possible interpretation. It's my best advice.
Okay.
And then this one's a good one, too.
Well, but also you have a question to answer. If he says that and you believe that there was no doubt, why did he say it?
Well, I mean, I'll take a stab at that one. I mean, at some point, the wrath of God had to be poured out on Jesus. And I think that when he was being crucified, the separation that Jesus experienced was the Trinity kind of exploded a little bit in my mind when Jesus died, because the wrath of God was poured out on Jesus, and it was a break. It's sort of like, this is forgiving, this is not necessarily biblical, this is Dan theology, I guess you could say, so take it with a grain of salt, but kind of think of the Trinity as a circle, and when Jesus died, the circle was opened. And people are able to kind of join in, not that we become God, but that we now have a relationship with God that is altogether different than the relationship that we could have experienced without Jesus having taken on the wrath of God and that relationship open, so to speak, to us. So I think he really did take on the sin of the world.
And for him to take on the sin of the world, he had to die the death of the sinner. He dies the death of the sinner, he takes on the sin of the world. His relationship with God is severed. He is, in many ways, forsaken from God at that moment. But because he lived a sinless life, and the whole Aslan C.S. Lewis example, you know, the world sort of breaks. And God does what God does because he's awesome.
I would say in that exact vein, I wouldn't disagree with what Dan's saying, I wouldn't disagree with what you're saying, of course I wouldn't disagree with what I'm saying. I think we'll find out when we get to heaven. We ask God, we're going to want to ask God simple questions like this. Why did you do X? And what are we looking for? That one answer to it. I did it because I was looking for the motivation. I did it because it was a fulfillment of prophecy. I did it because it's a break in transcendence, it's deeply theological, and this is how it all works out. You know what God's going to say is, how much time you got? There are 714 reasons, that's on the first layer. There are 21,833 reasons, that's at the second layer. How deep do you want to go? And what we're going to find out is all of this, all of it, everywhere, everything, including the shape of your coffee cup, plays into the way that God designed the world in with all these free will people in it so that it comes out to be the final product that he wants. We cannot conceive of it. It is absolutely amazing. So why did Jesus ask this question? I'll bet you there's, you know, 20 answers to that one in a moment. Steve.
We're saying that our motivation to be obedient is because logically it's the best thing to do.
So let me split it out and say, so yes and no.
And then compared to what other people are telling you why I should be obedient.
So it is not the motivation. Obedience is not the motivation. The motivation is selfish. This is the great thing about Jesus. The motivation is selfish. I want to be as happy as I possibly can be. That's a very selfish motivation. Question: how do I be as happy as I want to be? Answer: well, I need to want the things that are going to make me the most happy. Question: things that want to make me the most happy? Answer: you know, it seems to be that which is greatest. So if it's that which is greatest, then what should I want? Answer: well, what is greatest? Question: what is greatest? Answer: God is what is greatest. Okay, so to be selfish, I want God. All right, so far so good. No real rocket science here yet. Okay, how do I want God? Well, that seems complicated because it seems like there's a lot of stuff I have. Easy question. Did God tell me how to want God? Answer, yes. He took care of that too. Question. If he told me what to do, is it annoying yet? If he told me what to do, in order to be happy, what do I have to do? Obey. So really, when Mike gets up in the pulpit and says, here's the law of God and you should obey it, what he's doing is going through all those questions that I just asked and probably an irritating fashion. And he's short-circuiting them. And he's saying, if you want to be as happy as you can possibly be, obey the laws that God gave you, because that's the practical upshot, is in the long run, they will make you as happy as you can possibly be. So our motivation for obedience is our own happiness.
But you're saying I'm selfish.
I'm saying, yeah, but the question is being selfish wrong? I don't think it's wrong to be selfish. It's right to be selfish in certain ways. Now, what do we mean by selfish? If what we mean is there's coffee here on the table, and either Al can have it or I can have it, and I take it because I'm selfish and I want it, that's bad selfish. What's good selfish? There's coffee here that I made and that nobody else can even get access to before it goes bad, and I drink it. It's selfish to drink it, i.e. I'm thinking of my own self when I drink that coffee. You pretend coffee's good for you. That's what I mean by selfish. I mean in our own interest of self. The best thing is self-interest, proper self-interest, and proper God interest. Obedience to God's laws do both. God did not say, love thy neighbor exclusively. What did God say?
As thyself.
Let me break that down for you in case you disagree. Love yourself 50%. Love neighbor. 50%. You don't think selfish is good? You're taking exception to God's number one rule. Love your neighbor as yourself. What? You disagree with me?
I disagree. I don't think that selfishness is love.
Do you think that loving yourself is selfish?
No.
Okay, then we're just disagreeing on the definition of selfishness. Selfishness in this case just means, I'm meaning when we love ourselves.
I don't think that Jesus was selfish. And what is your claim?
You don't have to explain further. I'll stipulate. This is a definitional difference. Let me change it from selfish. When we do things for ourselves. Okay, so if that's not what you mean by selfish, then selfish is the wrong word. Forget selfish.
Just self-interest.
Self-interest. Yeah, that's fine. So, in this case, is it now, if we replace your original question of, is it wrong to love yourself? My answer is no. God tells us to love ourselves. God loves himself. All right? It would be wrong for him to hate himself. It would be evil. He has to love himself if he's good, and he is good.
I think the deal is doing something in your long-term, eternal self-interest.
Yes.
Allows you to do a lot of things that in your short-term, in this temporal world, do not appear to be in your self-interest.
That's a terrific way of putting it.
And that's kind of the rub.
So the original question you're asking, Steve, of, well, you said that this is a selfish motivation to want to be happy. Well, if want to be happy just means love yourself. That's all I mean. So if selfish is the wrong word, I apologize. Forget selfish. You want to love yourself, and loving yourself, you want to be happy. And you want to be happy because you do love yourself. Like God loves himself. Not in a bad way, in a good, proper way. Because if you exist, let's put it this way. Is your existence a gift? A gift of God? Then to disrespect your existence, to not think of you, is to spurn the gift of God. Best theological argument for self-thought or self-interest in this that there is out there.
I wish more people would make that distinction like that you're making, because I think there's a lot of confusion. Like, I think a lot of people could probably think, well, love is not self-seeking, 1 Corinthians 13, you know, and so if they're thinking, well, that could just cause a lot of confusion, and so I'm glad that you
I guess Skyler really made the distinction better. But, yeah. So we're out of time. Let me make the final point. This is really the final point I wanted to make last time. Obedience is the key to happiness. Obedience to the right person, the person that wrote the manual, the person that knows the playbook, the person that understands how it all works out. This is why obedience to God is so perfect. The reason, as Mason pointed out, that we don't do that in our 1-2-3 syllogism was this. It's not that we doubt that God knows it. It's not that we doubt that God knows it. It's that we disagree with God about what's going to make us happy. And what's the word that starts with S that is? Silly, stupid. It's just stupid. This is why knowledge is helpful. When you do truly know that this is true, then your motivation stops. It's the motivate, and this is why God gives us pain. Pain is a marathon for me. I'm at mile 18. God, it took 18 miles. It took 11 miles. It took 11 miles for me to figure out that what I'm doing is stupid for me. But I had to go through 11 miles of pain. Whereas if I'd have sat at the beginning and I just bothered to sit down, instead of saying, well, this guy asked me to go on a marathon. I like Carl. Well, Carl will think that I'm fit. I'm in shape. I want to think I'm a good Marine. He asked me to go on this marathon. And instead of telling him, actually, marathons are not in my own self-interest, and I don't gain anything from them. I'd be happy to go and wave a flag while you run by. And once you pass me, I'll laugh at you a little bit. Rather than say that, because that deems my own pride, what I'll say is, yeah, man, I'll join you on that thing. And on mile 11, I'm like, God, why did I do this again? That, just sitting and thinking about it. What do we do to sit and think about it? What's the word that we use for sitting and thinking?
Meditating.
And if we're meditating on the things of God instead of the things of man, instead of the things of this world, we don't have, and this is obviously a kind of a false scenario, but and it's not terrible. There are good reasons to do it too. Chariots of Fire guy is a good reason. God, he said, God, I feel God's pleasure when I run. So for some people, that is the right thing to do. For other people, it's the wrong thing to do. Why? Because that was his purpose, it's not my purpose.
purpose. And I'm back to the original thing. When you know your purpose for God's purpose for you, or you at least know his purpose for you today, then to do that, obey, and you will be happy. And the more you do his purpose, the more he will enlighten you as to what your long-term purpose is, and you will see it. But it may be that you're on the cross, and you don't see it all. But when you come back, now you know it all. That will be a great day. Okay. We will display something.